I am Charlie Bennett, and this is the North Avenue Lounge. Welcome to the North Avenue Lounge. Thanks for tuning in. We have a guest host today. Cornelius Ejimofor is a graduate fellow at Georgia Tech and host of WREK's Sub-Saharan Vibes. He spoke with Herbert Weiss, senior fellow at the Ralph Bunche Institute of International Studies in New York City. Enjoy.
I am here with Herbert Weiss, He's a senior fellow at the Ralph Bunche Institute of International Studies, and he is an expert on the Congo. He has been studying them for quite a while, since the 1960s, in fact. And I will let him introduce himself. Good morning, Mr. Weiss.
Good morning. Well, as you indicated, I've studied the Democratic Republic of the Congo since the 1960s. My first assignment there for MIT was to do an analysis of the independence struggle, and I did that between, the end of 1959 and early 1961, and that then resulted in a book called Political Protest in the Congo that Princeton University Press published. And that was later translated into French. And since then, I've gone back many times, and I've analyzed essentially, broadly speaking, political developments, but with a focus on protest movements of one kind or another.
Mr. Weiss is here at Georgia Tech as part of Africa Atlanta, the year-long festival of African culture and music and art here. And one of the things he has done is he's donated part of his personal collection of maps to the Museum of Papermaking at the Institute of Paper Science and Technology on 10th Street, which is part of Georgia Tech. So there's an ongoing exhibition of African art called Mapping Place, Africa Beyond Paper there. And he has his personal maps there. Let's start there. Could you tell us a little bit about these maps that you donated?
Well, these are maps that I needed in order to travel around the Congo in mainly 1960. I used them in a very functional fashion. That is to say, I scribbled on them. I used them as I drove my little Volkswagen all over the country at the time. And I was actually surprised that the paper museum here at Georgia Tech found them to be worthy of showing in its exhibition of much more valuable maps that are historical and so on and so forth. They are interesting simply as the traveling tools of a scholar in 1960 in what was for half that year still the Belgian Congo, and the second half of that year the newly independent Democratic Republic of the Congo.
So those maps were really interesting, and I think we can talk about them a little bit later. And one other thing I want to mention, he also gave a lecture here at the IPST as part of Africa Atlanta. But there was a development of those maps. So they look different from the maps of the Congo or Africa you see today. What else has changed in the Congo over the time you've been there? What have you seen change in the way people perceive them as those maps, the way those maps are drawn?
Well, first of all, the administrative divisions that existed at the time and that were drawn, of course, by the Belgian colonial administration changed several times over over those 50 and some years. There was a period, for instance, in 1963 when the Congolese decided to have many more provinces, 23 in fact, if I remember correctly, instead of the six that they inherited from the colonial period. Those decisions were, of course, very important from a political and sociological point of view, because the political dynamic of these small provinces was largely dominated by single ethnic groups, whereas these large provinces were inevitably vastly multi-ethnic. So that's one of the things. Then, of course, after 1965, Joseph Mobutu organized a second coup. The first one was in September of 1960, and became, in effect, the dictator of the Congo for the next 30-some years. He was bothered by the ethnically dominated nature of these little provinces and proceeded to reorganize the administrative divisions into more concentrated units. He also did something rather daring, which was that he forbade people in the administration from administering any functions in their own provinces. So all administrators, in effect, became, from the point of view of the local population, quotes, foreigners. That is to say, they came from other provinces. Sometimes they didn't even speak the local languages. At the same time, however, he built up a whole separate structure, which was a political party called the MPR. And that political structure based itself on, at the local level, on people who had some popularity, because they were supposed to mobilize people to support his regime and his political party, which was the only political party allowed at that time. So you had these two structures, the administration, for a while between 1969-72, always run by people who were not locals. And you had the political party, which had a lot of power, run exclusively by people who were not only locals, but popular locals. And of course, those the leaders of those two structures at all levels came into sharp conflict with one another, which actually was quite interesting because it gave ordinary people, for the first time, the ability to articulate complaints, grievances to a powerful institution other than the one against whom they had the grievance. Previously, there was this monolithic colonial administration. Now, if you had a grievance against the colonial administrator, who could you go to complain? Well, you had to go to the colonial administrator. Well, that was, in a way, counterproductive, suicidal in a certain sense. Not, I don't mean that literally. But here, for the first time, you had the ability, if the party leader did something you thought was illegitimate or hurtful to you, you could go to the administrator, who had a lot of power. He had the power of the state behind him. Vice versa, if the administrator did something to you that you found objectionable, you could go to the party leader, and he had a lot of power. Both of those structures led up to the president, who was President Mobutu. Yeah. So that was an interesting moment. Unfortunately, in my opinion, Mobutu found that this resulted in endless quarrels, which his higher-ups had to resolve. So there was endless conflict because people complained and had an ability to send their complaints up the ladder. And so he decided this is messy. So he synchronized those two structures. And after 1972, we returned, in fact, to a system where there was only one real authority. Now, all of this, of course, was related to, getting back to maps, all of this was to a certain extent related to the way the administrative units were defined geographically. Because, let's say, you were in something called a territory. Okay, how many territories were there in the whole country? At the time, probably around 200. Huh? So, but then you could go a step higher up and you would be at the district level. All of this, of course, was defined on maps. So maps were quite important. Another area where maps were important were later on, after the end of Mobutu, when the country was invaded, and even later on, when it was in fact divided into two different political arenas, the Kinshasa-controlled area in the west and the south, and the so-called rebel-controlled areas in the north and in the east. But that gets us far into the future.
Okay, that's interesting. It seemed like he set up a balance of power dynamic, and then he decided he didn't want it. So do you think that was intentional, to have that balance of power between those two groups?
Since it only lasted for about 3 years, I think it was not really intentional in the sense in the way it ultimately worked itself out. In other words, he had two motives. He wanted to create a national identity, and he realized that so long as administrators representing the state were of the same ethnic regional origin as the people they ruled, the effect of that was divisive, because it created very strong local loyalties. So he was against that, and he wanted a much more centralized as administration, and he wanted to create a stronger national identity as against local, ethnic, or regional identities. So that was one motive. Then the other motive was he understood that his regime would be enormously strengthened if he could mobilize the masses in support of his regime. So he created this single political party, which was a pattern in Africa at the time. So that was the reason why he created the MPR, this political party that he heavily financed, and of which he was, of course, the indisputable leader. The dynamic that worked itself out, especially on the local level, between those two, I think just sort of happened. It was not anticipated. It was not desired. And the fact that he ended it, the dynamic of conflict and competition, the fact that he ended it so soon suggests that he didn't like the result.
Okay, we're here talking with Herbert Weiss, an international diplomat and scholar. We will take a break and be right back right after this.
Go, 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 Jackets! Go, 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 Jackets!
Join the Ramblin' Rec Report for talk on Georgia Tech football, baseball, basketball, and more. Hear from our Ramblin' Rec crew, as well as analysts from around the country and coaches and players from the Georgia Tech teams. All of the fun starts right here at 6 o'clock every Wednesday on WREK Atlanta 91.1. Or catch us on Twitter at WREK Sports. Go Jackets!
All right, we're back talking with Herbert Weiss, a featured speaker here at as part of Africa Atlanta, which is one of the it's a year-long celebration of art that Georgia Tech is partnering with other institutions to do. And we've been talking about the Congo and some of the political structures of the early Congo in the 1960s. So a lot of things have happened in the Congo. Let's get back to present day. Is the Congo peaceful? I know that's a really simple question. It's not that simple. What's the Congo like today?
Well, it's a simple question, and the answer is even more simple. No.
Are parts of the Congo peaceful? Everyone thinks of Africa as unstable, as fighting. Are there parts of the Congo you could, you know, go out to your house and stroll down the street?
This is, I think, a very good and important question. Because whereas the eastern part of the Congo is one of the most violent areas of Africa today, with enormous casualty figures, I would say more than two-thirds of the country is relatively non-violent. There are all kinds of problems, but if we're focusing on violence, on militia, on warfare, it's absent in most of the Congo. And some people would argue that, for instance, Kinshasa, the capital of the Congo, which today numbers about 10 million people, is probably one of the less dangerous cities of that size in Africa. I have not been able to make a real comparison there, so that's off the top of my head. But I've heard people say that, who have traveled to other capitals and so on.
So these the parts of the country that are not in conflict, is what's the status of the everyday person? Is there middle class? Is there development?
Well, as in so many developing countries, you have just a fantastically huge difference in a small, economically powerful and wealthy elite and ordinary people at the bottom of society, the vast, vast majority, who live under really, really deplorable conditions of missing many, many essentials of life. There has been a gradual decline, sometimes not so gradual, in the standard of living of the majority of the Congolese over the last 50 years. There is a small growing middle class. Now, middle class has to be defined here. So, in other words, there are people who work in offices. There are officers of the army that cannot be considered poverty-stricken, but an officer will earn something like $60, $100 a month, and things are very expensive there. You know, a bottle of water costs a dollar. So, I mean, it's not the country where a few pennies gets you anything serious to eat, to drink, etc. So how do people survive? Well, through the informal economy. Basically, what we would call the hustle. And a big part of that for people with any kind of governmental authority is bribery. If you want to get any license, you're going to have to do more than pay the official price. The guy who signs will want something. The courts, the judges are completely underpaid. You couldn't live on that. A judge, after all, has a certain status in society. What he is paid officially is totally inadequate. to maintain any sort of a standard of living that is appropriate for somebody who is a judge. Well, how does he maintain that standard of living? Well, there are the under-the-table methods, and that is kind of a curse on the country. The degree of corruption that you have at just about all levels of society. But it is, in the last analysis, a system, an economic system, so that people do survive. And one of the positive things to remark is what you pointed to, namely that for about two-thirds of the country, there is no organized violence. Of course, there's criminality, but even that is sort of held in check. But, you know, let's say you're driving a car, the chances are they will stop, so police will stop you and now examine the car, technical checkup. And, you know, they'll find something. And then the issue is, well, how do we get out of this situation? And basically, at that point, money talks.
You describing a situation that I think exists in a lot of parts of Africa. But a lot of parts of Africa, people are complaining about it. And there's some places the young people are talking about actually doing things to try and change that culture. Do you see that happening in the Congo?
There's a great deal of talk about changing, but the problem with changing is you get into the issue of political power. How do you change things? You'd have to change political power. And certainly the regime in power in the Congo currently is tends to be very authoritarian, and through various methods manages to stay in power and is not really open to sharing power or to allowing a democratic process to take full force, which would probably result in it being kicked out of power.
All right, let's go and move a little bit on the map away from our peaceful portions back to the eastern portion. There is violence, and this is violence that's been talked about in the world media for a while. I remember a couple years ago there were campaigns here. People had the faces of some rebel leaders on their T-shirts to send money to this, and there were YouTube videos describing child soldiers. And what do you see happening there in terms of the part that where there is conflict? What do you see? Is there a resolution in sight? And what are the issues involving that conflict?
Well, the Eastern Congo is a very, very complicated arena. And I suppose one way of dealing with it would be to make a dichotomy between foreign militia groups that are using that area either to assert themselves or as bases to attack the countries from whence they come. There are Ugandan militia groups in eastern Congo. There are Rwandan militia groups in eastern Congo. There are Burundian militia groups in eastern Congo. There are two types of Rwandan connected militia groups in eastern Congo. One, the FDLR, these are Rwandan Hutu who are associated, whose leaders certainly were involved in the genocide against the Tutsi population of Rwanda in 1994. And who, when the Tutsi won the civil war in 1994 in Rwanda, massively moved into the Congo. About 1 million of them moved into the Congo. Eventually, about 80% of them returned to Rwanda, but that meant that there were 200,000 Rwandan Hutu who remained in the Congo, who were militarily organized, who got support from abroad, from some Congolese sources, and who had every intention of returning and overthrowing the now Tutsi-dominated government of Rwanda. Now, those forces have had a very negative effect on Eastern Congolese societies and structures. And then they, with all the violence that they created, brought about a situation where a lot of Congolese militia groups were formed. And they go by the generic term Mai Mai. So you have about maybe 20 to 40 Congolese militia groups in the east and a whole bunch of foreign militia groups in the east. Now, as time passed, there were all kinds of opportunistic alliances among these militia groups, between the Congolese government and some of these militia groups, between these foreign governments and some of these militia groups. So it's very, very complicated. And what has happened more recently is, as you know, there is a United Nations peacekeeping force in the Congo. There has been there for the last 15 years. And it has, with the support of the Security Council, gained more and more authority to deal with, initially, the foreign militia groups. And they have gone after the Rwandan Tutsi-related militia group, that the last one in a series called the M23. And they are now going after the FDLR, and they're going after some Ugandan militia groups. And that is done in conjunction with a new brigade that has been created, placed under the United Nations, but exclusively made up of African troops from Tanzania and from other countries. So there is a dynamic change occurring, especially regarding some of the foreign militia groups. But all of this violence, millions of casualties, all of this has created a kind of social decomposition. So you have Congolese militia groups made up of young men who really just live by the gun in a very, very uncontrolled and anarchic fashion. They go after their own villages sometimes. They go after their own women. There's an enormous amount of abuse of women, raping of women, torturing women. So the East is really in a very difficult situation. And then, of course, what you have is a lot of mineral resources in the East, which are very valuable. So there's a relationship between mining, and then, so again, there you have to make a division between mining that's industrial mining as against artisanal mining. But certainly mining and selling of these minerals has fed into, to some degree, the growth of this violence.
You said they are young men. How young are they?
Well, they can be children of eight, but I think the majority are young men who have no jobs.
So I was trying to get into the issue of child soldiers. Is that still going on?
Absolutely. And everybody has child soldiers. The Congolese army has child soldiers. The militia groups have child soldiers. The foreign militia have child soldiers. The Mai Mai have child soldiers.
So you said there's a new UN force that's being composed largely of African troops. How is this? Is there any connection between the UN forces and the African Union? Is the African Union doing anything specific in terms of controlling the violence?
Well, the African Union is not doing anything directly except passing resolutions against it and that sort of thing. There's been a regional agreement recently signed, which, if it were to be fulfilled, would certainly bring a lot of positive developments, but that's to be seen in the future. But the African Union has certainly been involved in creating this brigade, which is, however, placed under UN authority. So the African Union has been a key element in creating, well, first of all, in supporting the UN force in the Congo. But secondly, making that even more concrete by supporting the creation of a specific African brigade, which is not called an African brigade. It's called the International something or other brigade. And it is placed under the United Nations. Now, one of the key reasons why it has been placed under the United Nations, and of course the peacekeeping mission in the Congo is called MONUSCO. Those are the initials of that mission. And the reason why is partly because the UN can finance this, whereas it would be very difficult, I think, for the African Union to find the financial resources from its member states to finance its own brigade and to supply it with what it needs in the way of supplies. Furthermore, there was also an issue, would there be two military, international, independent of each other missions in the Congo, you know, and so there was they anticipated some problems would arise if that were to be the case. So the agreement was, we'll create this brigade, but place it under the already existing UN peacekeeping mission.
Okay, we've been talking with Herbert Weiss, an international diplomat, about conflict in the Congo. We're going to take a break and come right back here on WRIK Atlanta on North Avenue Lounge.
This is Ira Glass of This American Life, and you're listening to WRIK Atlanta. Music you don't hear on the radio.
Good afternoon, everyone. We're here on North Avenue Lounge on WRIK Atlanta. I'm here with Herbert Weiss, an international scholar, and we're talking about the Congo and conflicts in the Congo. So let me ask you this. You gave us a speech as part of Africa Atlanta on a particular conflict in the Congo in the early 60s. How could we go back and talk a little bit about how the tensions in the colonial and post-colonial period kind of led to present day?
Well, first let me correct you. The speech I gave, the lecture I gave, was about a revolt in 1931. So the lecture I gave was not about the 60s. But I'd be happy to answer about conflict in the 60s, which has been certainly one of my main concentrations.
Okay. So could we talk about what happened in the immediate independence period and immediate post-independence period, and then see if we can maybe try and talk about how that led into present-day conflicts?
Sure. Let me first describe a little bit the special features of Belgian colonial rule, and therefore, to some degree, the special features of the independence struggle, because I think that colors a lot of what happened afterwards. So Belgian colonial rule is usually described as having been particularly heavily paternalistic, and I think that's a correct description. In terms of social policy, the dominant influence of that colonial system was the Catholic Church. And the Catholic Church was more interested in conversion, obviously, than in anything else. And that resulted in a policy where it emphasized primary school education, because that went hand in hand with conversion to Catholicism. The catechism, the ABCs, and your multiplication table. The Belgian Congo produced a much higher degree of simple primary school education than most other colonial systems, the British, the French, or the Portuguese. But what they did not do was allow people in any number to go to high school, and until very, very late in the game, nobody went to a university. There was no university training. And that was in sharp contrast to both the British and the French colonial systems. They had their differences, but they did produce university graduates relatively early in the game of colonial rule. The result that was that at the moment of independence in 1960, there was not a single lawyer, there was not a single medical doctor, there was not a single engineer, there was not a single architect in this vast country. I mean, when I say single, of course, I mean Congolese. On the other hand, part of the policy of conversion by the church resulted in a rather strong emphasis on creating Congolese clergy. And this clergy was highly educated. If you became a Catholic priest in the Congo, you had to learn Latin, you had to know Greek, classical Greek, and of course, massive amounts of theology. So there was an intellectual class, if you like, but it was either made up of priests or made up of former seminary students. So at the time of independence, there were some 3,000 Congolese former seminary students who had had at least some of this education, although didn't get to the very final end. And there were over 500 Congolese priests, practicing priests, who had been ordained. That actually, if you consider that as an intellectual class, that made the Congo having more intellectuals than many of the surrounding French and British colonies. But of course, they were in a structure that, by and large, disciplined them not to get involved in politics, and they had no skills in governance or in any of the lay liberal professions. Okay? So then comes independence, and it came rather quickly. Now, the independence struggle had different characteristics in different provinces. But one thing that stands out, in my opinion, is the contrast in what ordinary people in the rural areas actually saw this independence as producing, as against these more urban elites that led the political parties that had mobilized them. Because it was the mobilization of the urban and rural masses that, in effect, put the pressure on the colonial rulers to throw in the sponge and end colonial rule. So, to put it very briefly, I think that these elites basically wanted to Africanize the system that was in place. They wanted to replace themselves with the Belgians who were there ruling it, filling the administrative posts. Whereas at the mass level, this paternalistic rule that determined so many things in their lives, what crops they should grow, where they should dig a hole for their latrines, when they would be inoculated and when not inoculated, who would decide their quarrels among each other, Belgian law, their traditional law, etc., etc., etc. So at the mass level, it seemed to me there was a desire and a hope that independence would end this system. So you have this, first of all, you have this contrast between the elites and the masses. Now then came independence, very suddenly, with no preparation to speak of. And 4 days after independence, the colonial army, entirely officered by white officers, by Belgian officers, mutinied. Why did they mutiny? Well, of course, it's hard to say. But clearly, one of the reasons was that a sergeant in this army, and that's the highest post you could achieve, was sort of the equivalent of a school teacher until the end of colonial rule. But the school teacher was able to join a political party, and he now had a car, and he was a minister or a deputy minister in the new government. The sergeant remained the sergeant. Well, you can see that from the point of view of this army, they saw this whole independence thing as getting them nothing, and so they mutinied. There were other reasons for the mutiny, but I think that's, sociologically speaking, the underlying reason. As a result of that, the country collapsed into a state, immediately after independence, a state of anarchy. There was no army. There was no police. How was the government going to rule? And in any case, these ministers, some of them had never even been in their office because it was so quick between independence and, okay, you're the minister of so-and-so, where's my office? You know, and then there's the mutiny, and now we're in a state of anarchy. So it was very, very difficult at the beginning. And, of course, Patrice Lumumba was the prime minister, and he was quickly condemned, identified as being sympathetic to the communist world at a time when the Cold War dominated just about everything in the world. And he tried desperately to get on the good side of the United States, but his attempts were ignored. And very quickly, the United States, the CIA, plotted his downfall, to put it very bluntly. And less than 3 months after independence, one of his lieutenants, Joseph Mobutu, with the help of the CIA, in effect neutralized him. It was a tragic mistake, I think, on our part, the U.S., because although he wanted to be a sort of neutral, like Nkrumah in Ghana, he was not at that point or ever in any way allied or the tool of the communist world. On the contrary, one of the first things he did when he saw his army mutiny and become useless to him was to request the United States to send 3,000 American troops to the Congo to help restore order. Well, a communist or a communist stooge is not likely to ask for American troops. So, you know, but that was ignored and other things he did that tried. Then, of course, when he was rejected, that's when he said, okay, now I'll turn to the other side. And he asked the Soviet Union to send some troops. And that proved to the United States and to the Western Europeans that he was, in fact, the communist stooge. But that was a big mistake. Now, what was the price paid by the Congolese for that misanalysis? Standard of living immediately collapsed in the Congo. Mobutu and some young students tried to control the government very unsuccessfully. The mutiny was more or less bought off and calmed itself down. And the government that emerged was very much beholden to the United States. The Belgians, being a small country, sort of fell into the background at that point. Now, these rejected Lumumbists, these allies of Lumumba that had won an election, but were now thrown out of power by the coup d'etat, they went into exile, of course. They were in danger. And some of them then came back and started a revolutionary movement. That revolutionary movement did have political and moral support from the communist world. So it was like a self-fulfilling prophecy. And that revolutionary movement was quite successful and gained control over a good half of the country. Materially speaking, they got almost no support from the communist world. But diplomatically and morally speaking, they did. On the other hand, the authorities, the government authority, the Western-supported government, did get a lot of material support, especially from the United States. Financially, we built them a small air force, which strafed the rebels. We hired anti-Castro pilots that were in Miami to pilot these planes. We paid for a lot of white mercenaries who were sort of professional white soldiers to fight for the against the rebel forces. And in the end, that war against that revolutionary movement succeeded. By 1968, it was all over. By the end of 1964, it was already clear that it was going to fail. Yeah? But that war, which I think was a direct consequence of the exclusion of these Lumumbist leaders and then the killing of Lumumba and this whole thing that I've just described, really probably cost the Congolese something like a million lives. And I would think that although conditions in the rural areas especially were very ripe for revolution, without those leaders, it is doubtful that that revolution would have taken off.
We're here talking with Herbert Weiss here on North Avenue Lounge. We're going to take a break and be right back.
Get your weekly cup of Joe. Hear banjos and country, folk, bluegrass, and American traditional on Back Alley Pork Roost, Sunday nights at 9. Only on WREK, Atlanta.
We're here with Herbert Weiss, who came as he was a featured speaker as part of Africa Atlanta 2012. We were talking about the Congo, and I'll go ahead and get started. So, Mr. Vice, could we talk a little bit about the Mobutu regime and how that affected the Congo and standard of living there and mm-hmm. and what Mobutu did, basically?
Okay, well, I've already described how in September of 1960, Mobutu, in effect, neutralized Lumumba and also the then, supposedly, the then sitting president, because Lumumba was prime minister. The president was a man by the name of Kasavubu. And ostensibly, the first Mobutu coup neutralized both of them. But in point of fact, especially with a helpful hand for Kasavubu, given by both the United States and the United Nations, the international community biased very heavily against Lumumba. Now, the next few years were years that excluded the Lumumbists. They then started the revolution I've just spoken about. The revolution is defeated. And in 1965, Mobutu conducts a second coup, the result of which is that he himself now becomes president. He's not in the background neutralizing people, but he's now officially becomes president. And for the next 30-some years, he is president of the Congo. Now, his regime, I think, can be summarized in the following fashion. First of all, he's a great ally of the West, of the United States, in the context of the Cold War. Straight down the line, and supported 100% for that reason. Secondly, internally in the Congo, he makes a great effort to create a sense of Congolese nationhood, which doesn't really exist at the beginning. For instance, there are parts of the Congo that attempted to secede immediately after independence. He fights heavily against that. He creates a very centralized government, and he creates the symbols of nationhood again and again. For instance, he puts a lot of effort, a lot of money into creating a national football team that wins against African teams. And that, of course, at the popular level becomes a source of pride and identity. You may recall also the Muhammad Ali Fraser boxing match in what was then, I guess it was already Kinshasa, that again became sort of a great symbol of we the Congolese have hosted this thing and so on and so forth. And as I've also explained earlier, he did things administratively that tried to break down the strong presence of ethnic identity. The third thing to say about him is that economically speaking, despite the fact that the Congo had enormous riches and that at the time it still had a functioning administrative structure, he allowed all of that to go down the drain. He allowed corruption to dominate all relationships. And the standard of living under his rule kept declining, declining, declining for ordinary people. So those are really the three characteristics of his regime. Towards the end, he found himself under pressure both internationally. The United States started as the Cold War ended. The pressure from the United States for him to liberalize, democratize, became ever greater. Internally, there were forces that demanded more rights. he tried to appease those in various ways while retaining ultimately his control over the key elements of government. These forces that were quite substantial did not end his regime. What ended his regime was an invasion by neighbors who saw the Congo, first of all, as very weak, and events proved that to be the case, and also strongly objected to the fact that he was hosting and supporting violent movements that were using the Congo as a base to attack their home countries. What were those home countries? Well, Angola, for instance. There was a movement called UNITA, which had bases in the Congo and which was attacking Angola and the Angolan government. Well, clearly, they didn't like the guy who was hosting this movement. The Rwandans, I had already mentioned that a million Hutu had crossed over into the Congo, many of them militarized, and were using the Congo as basis to attack the new government, the new dominant force in Rwanda. Same story. The Ugandans had the same. So what happened in 1996 was those three countries decided, I guess primarily to go after the bases of those movements that had their military bases in the Congo, but just to go and invade the country. But the invasion is a dirty word, of course, so you try not to invade. So what they did was they helped create a so-called national liberation movement. They found an old revolutionary from that revolution in the 1960s that I was speaking about earlier by the name of Laurent Kabila. And they helped him create a movement. And whereas the main battles of this invasion were carried by these national armies, he created a big movement of young men, of children, that went forward, and then it turned out that that Mobutu's army was just nothing. Things were so corrupt that the officers, for instance, kept the money rather than buying ammunition. So here you had army units with no ammunition because the officers had stolen the money. So the army was useless. So all the army did was loot and retreat. And that was the end of the Mobutu regime. And what replaced it was this Laurent Kabila, who declared himself president, and a heavy presence, especially of the Rwandans, in that regime. Some of the, for instance, the chief of staff of the new Congolese army was in fact a Rwandan officer. Well, that, of course, created a whole new dynamic, which to a certain extent we've talked about in eastern Congo, where it played itself out in a very costly fashion.
Very interesting. I really want to thank you for your talk. Just to get back, could you say a little bit more about the papermaking exhibit and your maps there?
Yeah, okay. Well, I'm not a specialist on maps. I use maps. And I use the maps that are exhibited there during my travels in the Congo. And I was very pleased that, as I've already said, that they were exhibited, that they were considered valuable enough to be exhibited. I guess the value of the maps, although you should really be talking to the people who chose to exhibit them about this question, is the value is that there's something living about them. That is to say, they're not just sort of maps put on the wall, but they are maps that actually were used in field research in the Congo in a specific space of time, namely late 1959 to 1961. Needless to say, since then, I've also traveled in the Congo, and there are probably other maps somewhere. But since I was traveling extensively at that time, all these little roads that I covered were traced on the map. One thing to be said about the maps and about conditions in the Congo is, in those days, I was able to travel just about everywhere with a VW. Today, that would be totally, totally impossible, because the decline in the infrastructure in the Congo is such that many of those roads are not only totally impassable by an ordinary little car, but even by a 4x4 or even a truck. I mean, unfortunately, the roads in many places have become impassable, except for motorcycles. And even then, sometimes not. Now, in recent years, there has been some advance on that. The main arteries, the Chinese have gotten very active in building new roads that are asphalted with good drainage, and hopefully, despite the tropical rains that undermine every asphalt road that you can imagine, hopefully those roads will last for a while and will be maintained. But there are still main arteries where you cannot advance faster than 15 miles an hour.
Okay. So we've been talking with Herbert Weiss, and I want to thank him. He has a collection of maps that are the Institute of Paper Science and Technology Museum. They're going to be on display there for a while as part of Africa Atlanta. I do want to thank you. Thank you for coming to WREK, to Georgia Tech. And that's all we have for you here on North Avenue Lounge on WREK Atlanta.
You've been listening to the North Avenue Lounge, featuring an interview with Herbert Weiss by Cornelius Adjemafor. The exhibit they referred to in the interview has unfortunately already closed, but you can find out more about it and Herbert Weiss at AfricaAtlanta.org. Thanks again for tuning in.